All right. Good evening, everybody. How are you? Good. I'm Johnny DiLoretto from Fox 28 and ABC 6. It's good to see you all here. Unfortunately, we're inside, but this is still great, right? The food is great, and we're not sweating. And that's good. Okay. So, welcome to the Thurber Treat, the first of Thurber House's 24th season of literary picnics in 2009. This is actually Thurber House's 25th anniversary. Truly one of our cultural gems here, so we should be very proud, and I am proud to be part of it, so thank you for having me. We'd like to extend a special thanks to AEP for sponsoring the entire season of Literary Picnics, and I'd also like to thank WOSU Public Media, Three Dog Bakery, and finally, Party Panache Catering for the delicious food this evening. So now that's... I've actually eaten at both Party Panache and Three Dog Bakery. It's human quality stuff. It's good stuff. I've had it. So now please turn off all your pagers and cell phones, and please no texting. We know when you're doing that. It's very annoying. My wife does it all the time. And some of us are more annoying at it than others, quite frankly. Have you ever noticed that? You know, there's some of those people that just kind of go in with both hands and... Okay, so let me give you a little background of the Thurber Treat here. It started in 1991, and every year since 1991, the Thurber Summer Picnic Series has begun with this, the Thurber Treat. For this year's contest, in celebration of the 25th anniversary of Thurber House, writers were asked to tell us about an unforgettable experience or memory that they've had over the past quarter century that in some way involves the Thurber House. Now, before I introduce the 2009 treat winners, I'd like to read a story submitted by our 2007 children's writer in residence, Lisa Yee, to whom we gave a very honorable mention. The story is called "The Night the Ghost Got In, or Not." The Night the Ghost Got In, or Not. By Lisa Yee. Oh my God, who was that? Oh my God. Just kidding. I never believed in ghosts. As any sane person knows, ghosts are figments of overactive imaginations, poofs of dust or smoke, and/or hallucinations manifested by teenagers who stumble into old abandoned mansions at midnight and aren't smart enough to go home. During my Thurber Children's Writer-in-Residence interview, I was asked, "How do you feel about ghosts?" "Ghosts don't bother me," I scoffed. "I don't scare easily." Thurber House Writers-in-Residence enjoy a cozy two-bedroom attic apartment in James Thurber's childhood home, plus the run of his house after hours when the museum is closed. On my first night at Thurber House, I reveled in the luxury of being alone. This would be my home for the next 4 weeks, for a mom with two noisy kids, a noisy husband, and a noisy dog, the silence was intoxicating. Later, I unpacked my suitcase and set up my computer in the spare bedroom. I tested the couch. I checked out the kitchen's pots and pans, though I had no intention of cooking for a month. Then I opened the closet door. Okay, that was a mistake. It wasn't a closet at all. It was a 12-foot dead drop housing a steep spiral staircase that led to nowhere. If that weren't creepy enough, while nosing through the dresser drawers amidst the old maps and brochures of the area was a typed-up list of ghostly encounters past Thurber House authors had experienced. Suddenly, I thought I heard voices. The house creaked and seemed to come alive. It sounded like there were heavy footsteps outside my door. I then realized it's one thing to be glib about ghosts when you're on the phone 1,800 miles away, and another to be unafraid when you were all alone in a house that was built on the site of a lunatic asylum fire where many residents had perished, and in the same house where a previous resident had committed suicide. Or had he? In a panic, I made sure the door was locked and the windows were bolted. I moved the dresser in front of the creepy closet and checked under the beds for murderers laying in wait to kill a children's book author. As the days flew by, I stopped looking for ghosts and murderers. I mean, honestly, what would I have done if I actually found one? The house was hustling and bustling during the day with visitors and staff climbing the stairs, exploring the rooms, happily chatting away. But at night, the place was mine. I'd roam around, oblivious to the alleged ghost and or his cronies, read in the living room, linger in the dining room, sit in Thurber's bedroom, and daydream. All alone in my apartment, sometimes I'd hear someone walking around the house, just as James Thurber had reported when he was living here. He even wrote about it in The Night the Ghost Got In. It was kind of quaint, I thought. A house ghost. Although I knew there really was no such thing. Oh, sure, on occasion the bolted windows would fly open or the light bulbs would flicker. Okay, so the radio would change channels on its own. But this was an old house, and it could all be explained away like that spooky stairwell. It was, I was later informed, a fire escape and led to the floor below. An ardent blogger, I was chronicling my Thurber House experiences, and once when writing a satirical post about the literary ghost, my computer froze up, then replicated the blog page about 50 times. Odd, I thought. Still, I didn't let it faze me. By the time my Thurber House stay drew to a close, I had accomplished so much. I started a new novel, I taught writing workshops, and even visited the hospital emergency room. I fell flat on my face while jogging. But I hadn't met the ghost. Like that was even possible. I had an early morning flight back to the West Coast, so on my last night, I packed and went downstairs to put my luggage by the back door. Then I set my alarm for 4 a.m. and went to bed. At 4:45 a.m., I made my way downstairs to wait for my ride. Though it was still dark, I didn't bother with the lights. As I attempted to pass through a doorway from the dining room to the back office, something stopped me. I was confused, and all I could think was that it was a thick spider web. I flailed my arms and had to push to get through it. When I turned on the lights, I expected to see the shreds of the massive web I'd just broken through, but there was nothing, nothing there. Yet something had stopped me. And if it wasn't a gigantic spider web, then what was it? Truth be told, it felt sort of like Jell-O. But that would be impossible. It defied logic. Then it dawned on me. I smiled and proclaimed, "You are real, aren't you?" I'm not saying that I believe in ghosts, and I'm not saying I don't. All I'm saying is that I wasn't alone at Thurber House, and neither are you. Very nicely done, very nicely done. So you can see the quality of writers that Thurber celebrates and brings in and invites. This is a great place, and like I said, proud to be a part of it, and also proud to announce this year's treat winners. So are you ready to meet these folks? Okay, very good. First, you are going to meet Noel Wolfgram Evans, right here. He's a playwright who has had productions in New York City, Chicago, Columbus, Louisville, and Palm Springs. Did I say that right? Louisville? People get that. Louisville, Louisville. What do we say here?
Louisville.
Louisville. All right. And Palm Springs. This summer, his latest plays will be seen on stages in Canton and Cleveland, or Cleveland, as they say in Louisville. In addition, he is the theater editor for Umbrella Publishing and an advisor for Group Creativity Improv Projects, which is based in New York City. He has also written for a number of magazines and online outlets, but the thing he enjoys most is laughing with his family. And there they are, right there. Noel, come on up.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming out tonight. And of course, thank the Thurber House for this very nice award. My story is entitled The New Olden Times. Since moving to Columbus, I've had several moments of inspiration, connection, humor, and community at the Thurber House. But what sticks with me the most was the afternoon there I spent spiraling in an unadulterated depression. To begin, it was a spring afternoon, or more accurately, spring-like. I had no particular reason for stopping at Thurber House. I just planned to drop by, read a little something in the garden, perhaps step inside and see what was new, steal a few pens, and just generally soak in the Thurberosity of it all. My main motivator for stopping was to kill a little time, as I was running early to my next appointment. I was spending the day looking for a new pair of glasses, as mine had been broken that Saturday by my inconsiderate neighbor. Even taking into consideration his age, 4 and a half, Gabe Brownlee was still a horrendous person to live next to. He lives two doors down and finds it intensely amusing to test my reflexes by throwing things at me. Now, I'm not sure why this started. It wasn't, as many kids' actions are, an extension of some other game, because I rarely play with children. They're a race of people I do not completely understand. The Saturday in question was the, unfortunately, annual Johnson start of summer cookout. I was standing around with the neighbors, each of us pretending to like each other when we knew that the opposite was more accurately the case. And yet there we all were, choking down Mark Johnson's lighter fluid-flavored cheeseburgers, when I suddenly saw, from the corner of my eye, something flying towards me. Like any sensible adult, I squared myself to the object to get a better look. It turned out to be a dog's squeaky fire hydrant toy, and apparently it was upset with my glasses because it smashed into them fairly hard. I didn't want to, but in all the chaos, I fell down, and from my vantage point, I saw little Gabe Brownlee fleeing the scene. I envisioned him running to his room, wrapping his dirty, stubby fingers around a Crayola, and like some tiny scientist, writing with a fiendish laugh in his notebook, "Chico's squeaky hydrant, response time, zero." So that is how I found myself driving all over town, trying on glasses. As I pulled down Jefferson, the radio started playing "In a Big Country," an upbeat song from 1983. It reminded me of being 11, and it put me in a good frame of mind. As I pulled into the parking space, the song faded out and the DJ said, and I'm paraphrasing here because the hurt of his words has overcome my memory, "You're listening to the 80s classic In a Big Country by Big Country here on the home of great oldies." I stared slack-jawed at Thurber's place while the shock set in. I was hit on two fronts. First, and perhaps least important, the song is in no way a classic. It's a fun song, but classic in the tradition of Thriller or Sympathy for the Devil or Signed, Sealed, and Delivered. Why would you even think that? My anger over that classification quickly gave way to a more egregious concern. A song from my youth was on an oldies station. This was, to use the words of a great poet of my childhood, a shot to the heart. It was a mistake, I thought, a goofy mistake. I waited anxiously for the commercial to be over so I could be sure, absolutely sure, that I had heard correctly. The commercial dropped into "The Power of Love," a Huey Lewis song I remembered quite well. Had I just become old? I just sat there with the engine going and the music faintly playing out. Looking into the rearview mirror, I prepared to see my father smiling back at me. The music bounced around the car, but it sounded different, and no matter how low I turned it, it was still too loud. I would have just turned the radio off, but I really liked the song and I hadn't heard it in a long time, so. With Huey Lewis hanging in the air, I found myself dropping into despair and disappointment. It was just like the fifth grade dance all over again. I became aware of every gray hair, every wrinkle, every out of shape place on my body. It's an odd feeling, one's own blobbiness. I turned my car off and just sat. Doing the quick math, I realized that I was just the teenager away from being 50. There I stood, facing a crisis not uncommon, but also not easily fixable. Age is just the statement, right? Even though the music of my summer's past is playing on an oldies station, I still feel young. Is it all a hollow perception, though? Am I diluting the truth, like the heavyset woman who shops the junior department? It's an amazing thing being able to pinpoint the exact moment you went from people yelling, "Hey, you," to, "Excuse me, sir." In the span of 3.5 minutes, my life shifted. I knew it was coming. I knew I would get old, but I never expected it to happen in a parking space in front of the home of one of America's greatest humorists. I just kept repeating in my head, "I am old. I am old?" When suddenly I saw the silver lining, however small it was. I hopped out of the car and marched toward the house. My destination was the gift shop, where I was determined to talk my way into the use of what I now felt was a very deserved senior discount. Yeah.
That was great. It's so true. How'd he do, Anna? He was great, right? She was not worried at all.
No.
She knew. I would like to present you with this, your Thurber Treat Award.
Very nice.
Thank you very much. You're welcome. Okay. Martha Johnson Miller is a lifelong Columbus resident and graduate of Ohio Dominican University. She has been an active volunteer with the Thurber House since 1992, serving on the Adult and Children's Education Outreach Committees, among others. Ms. Miller has spent most of her career in community volunteer service and has received the Junior League of Columbus President's Award and the Mayor's Award for Voluntary Service as a member of the project POWER. POWER. That's some acronym. That's a literacy and GED program, the steering committee there. A former consumer frauds investigator for the Ohio Attorney General's Office. Holy mackerel. She now works as a substitute teacher for Columbus Area Catholic Schools. I give you Martha Johnson Miller.
The title of my story is Things That Go Bump in the Night. Can you hear me now? No? Now? Okay. Things That Go Bump in the Night. For a fleeting moment, as I rolled over in bed in response to a shrill ringing sound, I thought I was dreaming. In the wee hours of an early January Sunday morning, still mostly asleep, I picked up the phone, heard Leah's voice, and for some not so fleeting moments, anticipated a nightmare. My brain processed only a few of Leah's words, notably alarm and police, but my brain immediately recognized her tone, apprehension edging toward fear. I asked her if she had locked the door to the apartment after setting the alarm. The surge of relief when she replied yes woke me up a little more. Stay locked in. I'll be there in 10 minutes. You can watch for me out the window and for the police. They'll be there any minute. I pulled on a pair of jeans without bothering to tuck in my nightshirt, slipped into some loafers while explaining to my spouse the reason for my sudden departure, grabbed my purse and headed downstairs. With parka secured, I left the house for the reasonably short drive downtown. With the traffic lights on flash, I made the freeway entrance in short time. Cruising south on 71, I attempted to organize my thoughts. Leah had been collected enough to find my phone number and call me when the alarm went off at the Thurber House. She was safely locked in the writer in residence apartment, and the police were on their way. No weather or traffic was impeding my progress. So far, so good. Leah had arrived from Baltimore just after Columbus had welcomed in the new year with fireworks. Fireworks, those bursting rocket displays set off by pyrotechnic experts, those shimmering streaks made by Mother Nature's thunderstorms, and those ammo blasts from the rifle of the serial sniper haunting the South Outer Belt and its nearby environs. Before she came as Thurber House writer in residence and Ohio State University poetry lecturer, Leah and I had discussed the sniper. She'd seen the reports on CNN, 18 incidents so far, one fatality, investigation ongoing. She didn't know enough about Columbus geography to convince her five-year-old son of her presumed safety during her residency. The sniper's firing 5 miles away on the fringe of town, I assured Leah, and suggested using protractor-made circles to illustrate to her boy that her path and the sniper's path could not intersect. the circles worked. To welcome Leah at the airport, I'd worn my grandfather's aged top hat, accented with an obviously artificial rose. I'd nourished her with a fish sandwich at Ray Johnson's before getting her settled in with rental car, routes, and the house key. Her stay had been going really well. She enjoyed the staff, the house, the teaching, the drive to and from campus. She'd even gotten along with the ghost. But now, the house alarm was sounding, and the police were responding. And I hope she didn't think it was a sniper. On the exit ramp, I recalled my only other wee morning hours call to travel downtown. It had been several years earlier, in a similar situation, responding to an alarm in an area a few blocks south of Thurber House. Upon arriving at my building, I had found the police cruiser parked in front, taking up two spaces. I had to park half a block away and walk back. I had walked in the middle of the street, keys in hand, whistle in mouth, as the officer, a tall, muscular young man, armed, well-trained in handling these situations, had waited for me on the front steps. There had been no social chit-chat, no exchange of pleasantries between us as we headed for the door, only his inquiry of me. Would you like to go in first? I hoped I would not be meeting the same guy this trip. I saw the cruiser as I drove up to the house. The officer was completing a walk around the premises and greeted me as I exited the car. Leah waved from an upstairs window. Signs of hope, my brain murmured. By the time we got to the door, the officer had given me a full report on what he'd found, or rather, hadn't found. When he reached for the door handle, there was no question. He was going in first. Leah met us in the bookstore. Being surrounded by literature gave us comfort. Being accompanied by an armed guardian of the law gave us courage. We undertook a thorough, methodical search of the house and found no nefarious intruders, no indications of malfeasance or even mischief. We braved the basement, even the part the furnace doesn't heat and the light doesn't reach. I cringed at the sinister, shadowy, stacked boxes and chairs, but they made no menacing moves towards us. Our officer was convinced they concealed no perpetrator. He had the flashlight and the gun and the trained eyes. We headed upstairs for finalities. The culprit turned out to be a window in Suzanne's office. The aged wooden frame had shifted just enough to trigger the alarm, which startled all of us out of our respective wee hour routines. No broken glass, no bullet fragments, no bad guys. As I left the house, I swear I heard the ghost laughing. Thank you.
Here's your third retreat award, Martha Miller. Thank you. Okay, and lastly, Mark Sweetwood. Mark Sweetwood is the managing editor of The Vindicator in Youngstown, Ohio. Good Italian town.
He and his wife, Mary, are new to Ohio, but old friends of Thurber, who Mark first met as a freshman in an American literature class at Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois. That's amazing. Wow, that's great. It's a big deal for you, right? Because you love Thurber.
Love him.
He eventually graduated, some would say was chased out, with a journalism degree in 1982. Clearly unable to spot trends, Marcus stubbornly worked at newspapers in Illinois, New York, and Florida before settling into Boardman Township. When not at work, Mark dances.
You do. Really?
Oh, dances with copyright infringement. Oh. When not at work, Mark dances with copyright infringement with his own blog, Mark's World, and Welcome to It. His second cat, hold on, page. That's, second cat was named Thurber. Even though Thurber was a dog man. He was a dog man? While his writing and editing have received numerous industry awards over the years, he considers the Thurber Treat his Pulitzer. Because clearly he's never going to win a Pulitzer. He wrote it! Mark Sweetwood, come on up.
Can you hear me in the back? My piece. By the way, thank you very much. This is my Pulitzer. I've been a huge Thurber fan. I have many first editions. I actually adapted my own 10 rules for a happy marriage as a reading when Mary and I got married in 1997. So my love of Mr. Thurber and this house and the work that all of you do all throughout the year. I'm a guy from Youngstown. But for all the work that you guys do day in and day out, it's fantastic, and it's really is a legacy to a great person, a great humorist, and someone I'm just and totally enthralled with. So, thank you for all that wonderful work and for having me here tonight. The title of my piece is "Alarms and Diversions: A Visit to the Thurber House," and it's subtitled "In Which the Would-Be Author Visits the Home of His Literary Hero, Only to Be Confronted by Chaos, Confusion, and of course the Threat of Arrest." We are currently at the Renaissance Hotel in Columbus, Ohio, awaiting an early evening private tour of the James Thurber House. Of course, this is all the result of a curious and chaotic course of events. Only now, after a stiff drink or three, have my nerves calmed enough so I can properly relate our story. Needless to say, the police were involved. We departed Crystal Lake, Illinois at 5:28 a.m. with two destinations in mind, the Columbus Renaissance Hotel and the James Thurber House at 77 Cleveland Street, Jefferson Street, I'm sorry. The boyhood home of my literary hero. This was to be the culmination of a lifelong dream I've had since the home opened in 1984. This is stage one of a two-stage plan to get us to Mary's mother's house in Corning, New York in time for an Italian Thanksgiving feast. There will be three for dinner. Like any good Italian woman, Mary's mom will cook for 13. My plan, like all plans written by men, left little room for error. Hence, we were at the hotel by 1 p.m. and at Thurber's house by 1:35 p.m. Now, I had traded emails with Marlene from the Thurber house earlier in the week, who assured me, quote, "Sundays are a good day to visit since we have tour guides available." In addition, she wrote, "Safely assume we're open unless I email you again." She did not. We safely assumed. We were all goose pimply with anticipation upon our arrival. We parked right in front of 77 Jefferson Street because the parking lot next to the house was locked shut. That should have been an omen. A cynic would have begun to panic. The Sweetwoods, well, we took up the offer on the sign on the front door and walked right in. Nice foyer. Now, at first we mistook the loud alarm as some sort of signal to someone. Maybe an employee in the back that guests had arrived. Then we heard a robotic voice warn us to exit the building immediately. The police have been notified. Not quite the welcome we had been promised. The robotic phrase repeated and seemed to get louder and more ominous. Confused, we retreated back to the front porch. Why would the door at this national landmark, a plaque assures it's a national landmark right there on the front porch, be unlocked if the house was closed. Why would the house be closed when a sign clearly says it is open on Sundays? And I have evidence. If you look closely, this picture right here, this sign, if you can all get closer. It says it's open from 1 to 4 on Sundays. Why would I be emailed? The house was open to visitors, only be rudely threatened with arrest. Perhaps this was not an alarm, but the voice of the infamous ghost, the day the ghost got in. Our minds whirled. That whirling coincided, by the way, with the lights marking the arrival of the first set of officers in a police van. The alarm had stopped, apparently convinced of our retreat, only to be started up again when the officers entered. By then, two more visitors arrived, convinced too by Thurber House staff that volunteers would be running tours from 1 to 4 p.m. They were locals and could easily reschedule. We had driven 413 miles, and I had Griswolded this stop in an impenetrable schedule, calling for our departure at 6 a.m. the following morning, some 7 hours before the house would allegedly be open again. A squad car now joined the police van at the scene, apparently alerted by the new set of alarms set up by the first set of officers. I am convinced Jefferson Street had not seen so much commotion since the day the dam broke. Certainly, it had seen so much confusion. I have a picture of the police van. That's right. And this is the second squad car, so. The latest officer joined his fellow officers inside, and Mary and I amused each other by taking a set of pictures that appeared to show me stealing Thurber's pumpkins. This is a pumpkin. For that, I received a Thurber sliver from Thurber's porch. I was beginning to turn a little surly. That's a great house. I've never been in Thurber's house before, one of the officers said as he exited. The officers declined to have their pictures taken. Nothing good ever comes out of having our pictures taken, one said, smiling. They did contact the alarm company, and someone was either going to show up to disable the alarm or call the Thurber House staff to alert them that the door was unlocked, and visitors, now numbering 4, were threatening to get unruly, or at least threatening to take a pumpkin home as a souvenir. Within 20 minutes, Chuck arrived. He's in charge of maintenance for the Jefferson Center, which oversees the Thurber House property. He let the 4 of us in, disabled the alarm, apologized for the missing volunteers, but further explained he could not stay as his mother is waiting in his car. We agreed he'd call us at 4 p.m. back to the Renaissance to arrange the full private tour treatment later in the evening. We headed back to the Renaissance, hopeful of a well-stocked bar. Optimistically speaking, the worst we could expect are more alarms at night. Thank you, that's my story. I should point out that actually Chuck did call us, and we did have a wonderful private tour, and I got to spend as long as we wanted to spend in the house, and we loved it, and the fact that I'm not reading this from the porch of the house serves as more irony, I think. But thank you very much.
Mark, here you go.
You're welcome. Appreciate it. Thank you.
No, thank you. Okay, those were great, right? Noel, Martha, and Mark, let's give them a big round of applause in appreciation of their prodigious talents.